Regular Current State listeners might remember a guest we had on the program about a month ago. Darren Sylvester teaches history at Salem High School in the Plymouth Canton Community School District. And the story was about Darren's work with his students over the past 10 years restoring an abandoned cemetery and all the things that they've learned about their local history in the Plymouth Canton area. Plymouth, this actually was, by restoring the cemetery. This has been a 10-year effort from Darren Sylvester. Lori Higgins of the Detroit Free Press updates the whole thing here today. She says that since the Free Press reported, I don't know if Current State can take any credit for this, but since the Detroit Free Press reported on this, and where we first saw the story too as well, truth be told, that donations and support have rolled in and helped Darren Sylvester boost his effort to reclaim the cemetery, beautify it, and do all kinds of things. It's called the Shearer Cemetery. It sits on top of a hill in North Territorial Road in Plymouth, Michigan. Very interesting. Check that out. Lori Higgins in today's Detroit Free Press. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Discussions involving the future of Michigan's energy policy will relaunch tomorrow in the State House of Representatives. The House Energy Committee will begin discussing The House Energy Committee will begin discussing a pair of closely watched measures that would constitute Michigan's biggest changes to energy policy in 8 years. 3 weeks ago, the state Senate passed the bills with bipartisan support, but our next guest, a key House Republican, opposes the energy measures, alleging they'll eliminate competition and raise Michigan's already high electricity rates. To find out why, we welcome the Vice Chair of the House Energy Committee, State Rep. Gary Glenn of Midland. Representative Glenn, welcome back to Current State.
You bet. My pleasure.
There are several parts to these bills, but your main problem, I know, is how you feel electric choice would be affected. Explain what's wrong for us.
Well, the best line I've heard was from Representative Tom Barrett, and he said, you can have your Model T in any color you want as long as it's black. And in the same way, the legislation purports to protect electricity choice, but it eliminates electricity choice savings by imposing new charges on the alternative energy suppliers, the competitors to DTE and consumers, so that their cost of doing business in Michigan will no longer offer any savings. They're going to put a special tax, a use tax, as it would amount to, on these alternative energy suppliers who say en masse that under these situations we would not be able to do business in Michigan. We could no longer offer savings. And if you want a preview of what would happen statewide, you just got to look to the lower southwest corner of Michigan, which is not served by DTE or consumers. It's actually in a conglomerate known as the Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland conglomerate for the delivery of electricity, as unusual as that might sound. But the alternative energy suppliers in the southwest corner of Michigan already would have to pay this quote-unquote capacity charge, this new tax that this legislation tries to impose on alternative energy suppliers all over the state. And the result in southwest Michigan is there is no electricity choice in southwest Michigan. They've run all the alternative competitors out of business, and that's what this Senate bill would do statewide. We already have the highest electricity rates in the Midwest, about 12th, 13th, 14th highest in the nation, depending on the month. This will drive electricity costs even higher.
We had our local state senator Curtis Hertel on the program shortly after the Senate passed this, and he supported them. Supported the measures. It's Senate bills 437 and 438, and he acknowledged that these were not perfect, but he said it was a sensible compromise. The capacity charge you're referring to, is that to maintain the grid? Do I have that right?
Well, that's purportedly the objective. I believe it's because, remember, this legislation is backed by utilities who started this legislative session by saying they wanted to eliminate electricity choice outright, just prohibit it, not allow it anywhere by law. I believe that remains their objective. In every element of this legislation, utilities seek to remove any competition. And as complex as this issue is, it really is simple to understand, I think. And after 9 months of testimony in 2015 and learning the issue, it dawned on me I knew everything I needed to know about this the day I walked in the door, when I had no particular background on electricity or the energy market. And that is, if you've got one grocery store in town and everybody has to shop at that one store, there's no incentive to keep the produce fresh or the floor swept or the prices competitive. But if you have two competing grocery stores who have to lower the price and offer better customer service because you as a consumer are free to choose, then the consumer gets a better product, a better price with better service. That fundamental economic principle that applies and we see at work in every other aspect of our lives, in my opinion, after 9 months of testimony a year ago, I concluded also applies to the provision of electricity in Michigan. And I think that's pretty simple to understand.
The bills you will look at, the bills passed by the Senate, preserves the choice market at 10%, doesn't it? You want to bump the 10%?
Oh, actually, the answer to your question is yes. I think in the ideal, we should go back to what was passed in 2000. And from 2000 to 2008, under legislation passed by Governor Engler, everybody in Michigan, commercial, residential, and industrial, was free to choose. And that's the last time our electricity rates were below the national average, instead of in the top 10 almost, and the highest in the Midwest. And it doesn't surprise me that when you had competition, that prices were lower. But you're saying that it maintains the 10% market is kind of the sleight of hand that I was referring to. It says you can continue to choose, but we're going to put this capacity charge on the competitors to the utilities so that buying from them no longer saves you money. And, Mark, 100 of the 110 House districts have at least one school district that is on the electricity choice market. So the school districts are opposed to this because it will take, for example, Clarkston Public Schools testified that they save $350,000 a year. And if you took away choice or made it more expensive to buy from the competing provider, that they'd have to lay off five teachers. It doesn't make sense. In my district, Bay City Schools saves $200,000 a year, but Midland, the Meridian, Pinconning, and Bullet Creek public schools are prohibited by law from doing the same thing. You have two restaurants in Frankenmuth across the street from each other, and one of them has a higher electricity bill of $25,000 a year. I think we ought to go back to the Engler model of allowing everyone the freedom to choose. And this is really, besides the substance of it, Mark, this core question rises to the top of all the talking points. Why in the world would a Republican-dominated legislature reimpose the Granholm model of monopolies, 90% guarantee of market share, the other 10% that are free to choose now will wither on the vine, as they predict, monopolies and mandates, when we are 45, 50 days away from a new Republican president who put a video out last week saying that on day one he was going to withdraw the restrictions on clean coal? Why would we continue to impose the Granholm model of mandates and monopolies when we have the opportunity starting in January to work with a Republican administration and develop a future-looking energy policy in Michigan that's based on free market principles like competition and consumer choice?
You've anticipated my next question here. I mean, you're at odds with the majority of your fellow Republicans in the Senate who voted to pass this bill, and I'm sure a number of them would say that electric choice is important to them. Help us understand, why does electric choice matter so much more to you than to them?
I cannot speak for any senator. I know that all the people who were opposed to it previously that are on choice, major manufacturers, the Michigan Manufacturers Association, Amway, Pfizer, General Motors, plus school districts all across the state, hundreds of school districts who, if they lose electricity choice, will be laying off teachers, remain opposed to these bills. So we're simply not buying that saying you can have any color you want as long as it's black is going to continue to protect these savings. If they want to protect these savings, then leave electricity choice alone. Don't impose new taxes on the people who are competing with consumers and DTE forcing them out of business and then say, oh, but we protected electricity choice. What value is electricity choice if there's nobody to choose from?
Republican State Representative Gary Glenn of Midland is with us. Mr. Glenn's the majority vice chair of the House Energy Committee, which this week begins considering two Senate bills addressing Michigan's energy policies. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, after the Senate passed the bills that you'll be taking up, Democratic Senator Curtis Hertel Jr. joined me to discuss his support of the bills. And the topic of reliability came up. This was a much-discussed aspect of these measures. How does Michigan ensure the reliability of supply with coal-fired plants going offline? He supported the Senate measures in part because he felt they adequately addressed the reliability issue. I asked him to explain. Let's listen to his answer, and then we'll have you comment. Here he is.
The issue is, I think the choice market actually hurt reliability in a sense, because they had very few regulations that were coming in. This actually makes sure that they have a reliable source long-term for the choice market, and that most of our investment is happening in-state with in-state workers who have a huge need to have that grid be stable. You know, an out-of-state company can leave at any time, and if the grid doesn't work, it doesn't really matter to them once they leave. Mm-hmm. A company that's here and supplies Michigan energy from Michigan has to have a grid all the time. So So requiring a larger part be Michigan-based is good for the whole system.
So Senator Hertel and others, I guess, fear that no accountability, no responsibility to maintain the grid here if with the out-of-state providers. Do they have a point?
Well, I understand why Senator Hertel and other Democrats would take that position. Some of the Democrats in the House Energy Committee have taken the same position, that we ought to force all energy production to be produced in Michigan with Michigan plants, Michigan workers. I understand that, but it would be have the same result in the market as if we said you can only eat at the or buy from the grocery store produce that's produced in Michigan, or you can only buy cars that are built in Michigan. The inevitable result of that is you're going to have some months of the winter where you're not going to get any grapes, and the price is going to skyrocket. So I can understand why Democrats want to have, you know, union-only power-producing jobs at Michigan plants only in Michigan, but it's going to raise rates on all ratepayers across Michigan. I don't think there is any reliability question. In fact, Hillsdale University did a study in which they found that Michigan's electricity market was not only the most expensive in the Midwest, but the least reliable. And the utilities, lobbyists, and others who support this bill act as if we are incapable of looking right across the line into the state of Ohio, where there is no guarantee of 90% market share in Ohio. There's an open market. Everybody's free to choose. And the utilities have said, we can't build a plant in Michigan unless you give us a guaranteed cash flow by law. And yet right now in Ohio, with a totally free and open market, six new plants are being built, one of them by DTE, who says they won't build one in Michigan unless they get 100% of the market guaranteed by law. So I don't think there's going to be any capacity or grid question. If you want a secure and efficient and cheap energy supply, electricity in particular, then you ought to have a diverse and competitive energy supply, not put all our eggs in two baskets, DTE and consumers. We ought to have every man a prepper. I mean, people who want to put solar shingles on their roofs, for example. This bill would also impose a new use tax on solar shingle users so that there'd no longer be any financial incentive to put solar shingles on your roof. So some of the environmental groups are in favor of encouraging solar. I'm in favor of encouraging solar. We don't need mandates or subsidies. But this legislation would impose a new use tax on people and make it less likely that anybody other than the utilities would try to invest in solar for their own home or otherwise commercially.
It's all about eliminating
competition. And I think we all know that in a common sense fashion, that if you have no competition, the price is going to go up.
Well, we have under a minute, Rep. Glenn. Legislatively here, what are your options? Are you out just to stop this thing, or is it realistic to think you could hammer out some kind of compromise here?
open to compromise, but unless it actually does protect electricity choice, and, you know, probably, I think there are more Republicans in the House caucus who are opposed to any increase in the renewable mandate than there are those who support choice. We haven't even talked about that. I think, you know, I don't know what our odds are going in, but I do intend to seek significant amendments or try to stop it and wait a month and work with a new Republican administration in a new environmental climate. One thing that I can, if I can squeeze in here at the last second,
quickly,
I've heard
please.
That it's possible that the chairman of the Energy Committee does not intend to hold public hearings on this legislation, and it's 140 pages, tie-barred to 80 pages, significant elements added on the Senate floor, which means the Senate did not hold hearings. And if we don't have any hearings in front of the House Energy Committee, then that means legislators are going to be faced with a 220-page package in language that is extremely difficult for anybody not on the Energy Committee to even understand. So,
no hearings were ever held.
You wouldn't know what it said, what it meant in many cases.
We got to let it go there.
If that's the case, it's simply irresponsible.
Republican State Representative Gary Glenn of Midland. Mr. Glenn's the majority vice chair of the House Energy Committee, which this week begins considering two Senate bills addressing Michigan's energy policies. Rep. Glenn, thank you.
You bet, Mark. My privilege as always.
Coming up on Current State, last year, then 20-year-old Jewel Jones became the youngest Inkster City Council member in history, now 21, the University of Michigan Dearborn student has won election to the State House of Representatives. We'll talk with Jewel Jones about its rapid rise through the political ranks. That's later this hour on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Recently in the news, there was a story of a young girl from London who died of cancer at the age of 14. She had wished for her remains to be cryogenically preserved upon her death with the hope that someday it might be possible for her to be revived and cured of cancer. Her remains have been cryopreserved here in Michigan, at the Cryonics Institute in Clinton Township near Detroit. It's one of only three cryonics facilities in the world. If you saw this story in the paper, it may have raised some questions about the topic and the Michigan facility. We've invited Patrick Heller, a senior board member of the Cryonics Institute, to the studio today to tell us more about how it all works. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
We want to clarify the difference here between cryonics and cryogenics. According to the Cryogenics Society, they're not the same thing. I think you would agree. Cryogenics is the physics of the production and effects of very low temperatures. What is cryonics then?
Cryonics is specifically using that technology for purposes of preserving humans and other animals with the idea that future medicine will be able to recover them, resuscitate them, cure what they died from, and rejuvenate them.
Some spectacular scientific breakthrough that awaits us that no one can anticipate today, in other words.
There's parts of it that have already happened.
What's already happened?
There are adults alive today that were frozen embryos at one time. It's pretty standard medical practice that there are females' eggs harvested and frozen at liquid nitrogen temperature to be later reimplanted to grow into human beings, and that's pretty standard that's
okay.
Done. You also had a report that came out in 2009 of a kidney tissue being frozen at liquid nitrogen temperature, thawed out and transplanted, and the patient that got it did long-term survival.
That was when they were still viable, though. The tissue was still had.
We can't harvest
viable.
That until people are legally dead and clinically dead. So that's the same standard by which we hope to place whole bodies into cryonic suspension.
Can you tell us how did Michigan come to have one of only three cryonics facilities in the whole world?
It's just by happenstance. There was a professor at Wayne State and Wayne County Community College named Robert Ettinger that wrote a book called The Prospect of Immortality in the early 1960s, and it gathered significant coverage. The science debunker Isaac Asimov actually read that and said, this is a sensible idea of what the future might bring. And people started to contact him, enough so that an organization was formed in the Detroit area. And later in 1976, the Cryonics Institute was formed to do the actual services.
How did you become involved?
I read some articles in the 1970s on the idea of cryonics, and like everybody else, said, well, the prospects of success are not zero. And I happened to be working in the Detroit area. In fact, I lived only about a mile from Robert Ettinger at the time. Mm. So it was easy to get a hold of them and become involved.
How many people are members at the Cryonics Institute?
The latest count, I believe, is around 1,400.
And there are two types of memberships involved. Can you explain that?
You can join for a one-time fee, or you can join to make continuing membership payments. The individual members, if you pay one time, is $1,250, and for a couple or a couple and their minor children is $1,875. Then if you want to, you know, if that's kind of hard to pay, you pay a smaller amount, $75 application fee, and then either $120 a year or $35 a quarter to continue your membership.
And this is to be frozen at your death with the hopes that someday you could have life restored.
That gets you a membership. You actually need to sign a contract for the services. The one-time payment members sign a contract for $28,000. The other members have to sign a contract with at least $35,000 funding.
I'm speaking with Patrick Heller, senior board member of the Cryonics Institute in Clinton Township, Southeast Michigan, which is one of three cryonics facilities in the world. There's been criticism of cryonics. I'm sure you're aware of it. Other scientists have said there is zero scientific evidence to support the idea that the people who have died could be frozen and brought back to life someday. But others say there's no point to it, or even that it's a scam. You've acknowledged you're not a scientist, but you have some responses to these criticisms. What are they?
Yes, I do. The prospects of success is not zero. And if you don't have your body preserved, your eventual revitalization is a zero probability. And you don't know what the future is. As time goes on, the definition of death, the various kinds of definitions change. There's a legal definition. There's a clinical definition. A clinical one is just, when do you stop breathing? When does your heart stop beating? And over time, people who have died a clinical death have been rejuvenated, such as with CPR. And over time, medical technology has been able to go farther into the biological process of dying and rescue people and, in effect, save their lives, even if they've been dead by previous clinical definitions.
Do you want to be cryopreserved someday?
If necessary. There's exciting research that for curing I figure it's a disease of death, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are some people walking on the earth today who will never die of old age.
What's the ultimate goal here, then? To be brought back to life once or repeated times?
Well, you don't know exactly how the life will go in the future. So this is I consider it like an ambulance to medicine of the future if you need it. I assume future medical capability will be able to go much farther into the dying process. So if you can preserve people at liquid nitrogen temperature where metabolism basically is at a standstill, future medicine may, and I'm hopeful about it, but they may have the ability to say, oh, they're not dead by today's standard. Let's go thaw them out, fix them up, and rejuvenate them so that they have an indefinite healthy lifespan.
I understand there are also religious-based objections to cryonics. What objections have you heard?
Some people are not comfortable with that from their own religious perspective. Although, for instance, we've had two ceremonies performed by Catholic priests. In one of the instances, the priest asked his bishop, can I administer last rites to this person? And the bishop's response was along the lines of, well, if they're never resuscitated, they are dead, and it's appropriate to do last rites. On the other hand, if cryonics is successful, that's God's will, and I will not be opposed to that. The Cryonics Institute has patients that have also had ceremonies performed by religious leaders of Jewish and Islamic faiths.
In a recent interview, I know the facility manager at the Cryonics Institute said that they refer to people as patients.
That's correct.
Not corpses.
Right. You have to be legally declared dead under current law in order to have your body preserved. But by future medical technology, you may not be dead. So we're thinking of them as patients that are capable of being alive in the future.
Are you hearing of more people open to this prospect over time? Or is the skepticism pretty steady?
People are getting more open to it over time. In the popular culture, I'd say half of the big-name movie and television stars have done programs or movies with a cryonics theme in it. I mean, like Mel Gibson and Tom Cruise and Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's the idea of a plot. You know, it's in the Star Trek, one of the recent movies. The idea of it is presented as, yeah, this is just a standard technological thing for the future. Mm-hmm. So it is becoming more accepted.
I've been speaking with Patrick Heller, senior board member of the Cryonics Institute in Clinton Township, Michigan, one of three cryonics facilities in the world. Mr. Heller, thank you.
I appreciate that, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, it was a barn burner at Ohio Stadium on Saturday for what was dubbed as the game between Ohio State and Michigan. Find out how the outcome has shifted the landscape of the college football playoffs when we talk with Current Sports host Al Martin later this hour. Also, the Lions, MSU football, and more. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We're always at WKAR.org. And don't forget the Current State podcast. All our segments are available whenever you want them there. iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other podcast locations, you'll find us there. In 2015, the people of Inkster voted then 20-year-old Jewel Jones to the city council. He became that city's youngest council member ever. On January 1st, he'll become state representative, Jewel Jones. Now 21, it's thought that he is the youngest person ever elected to the state house. The Democrat is a senior at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, studying political science and business. How does he feel about heading to the state capitol to serve? Let's find out. Jewel Jones, welcome to Current State.
Hey, good morning, brother. How are you doing?
I am well. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
How does it feel?
With my hands. I'm feeling good. Happy to be alive. Really looking forward to the opportunity.
It's a dramatic new chapter in your 21-year-old life. What do you think about most? What specific thing do you think about most when you anticipate serving in the legislature?
I think even what Ohio City Council, just the opportunity there to really make a really positive impact, especially being a young person, you know, coming from a different perspective. I'm talking to different people and different folk on a daily basis than the typical politician. So I think the ability to give more people access to resources is really something that I'm anticipating on happening when I get to the State House.
How did you first get interested in politics?
I think my parents really planted the seed when I was much younger, because they used to drag me around everywhere that they were at in the community and in the church. But really, I guess back in 2012 when I ran into David Knezik, who's currently my state senator, he's running for state representative back then. And I was just a high school student in the Chamber of Commerce, and he asked me to help him out on his campaign, and I think that's when I really started getting more actively engaged in the political arena.
Describe the district. Describe Inkster in the district you'll be representing.
So right now, Inkster is my hometown. It's about six square miles, 25,000 people just about right up under there. And the 11th district is all of Inkster, all of Garden City, half of Dearborn Heights, and then the sliver of Livonia and the sliver of Westland. And so it's the district has grown a bit, and it's a little diverse, but you know, none of the communities are all that different. So, and there's been people I've been working with on city council as well, so we're really looking forward to it.
How would you describe the priorities of the people who live in the 11th district? What do they feel most strongly about?
I know we're definitely always talking about education and public safety, but besides that, really income inequality and figuring out how to really empower individuals and strengthen families and get people on their feet again. I think that's some of the biggest things going on.
You grew up in the district. You've spent your whole life in the 11th, is that right?
Oh, yes, that's true.
Yeah. You'll be resigning from the Inkster City Council on Thursday. Do I have that right?
Not necessarily Thursday. It'll probably be at the next council meeting.
Okay.
So I can let the citizens know, make sure it's on air so everyone knows and there's no confusion, but... That'll be coming up pretty soon.
Well, you'll be sworn in as a state representative on New Year's Day, so you've got about a month to prepare for work in Lansing. How will you be preparing, Jewel?
Well, I know I've been to a few orientations. I've been talking to a lot of people and really just been traveling around hearing ideas and concerns about people in the district and figuring out how things really work out in Lansing, so when we get there, we're not inundated with a whole lot of information. We're trying to make sure it's a smooth transition. So just really talking to people, doing our relationship building, I think that's what's really going to help us out come January 1st.
How is it the Democrats in the 11th district turn to you during the primary season?
So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the race and how it occurred, but so the Honorable Julie Pawlecki, she had passed away. She's the current state representative back before she had just passed away. And so as soon as she passed away, the Democratic Party had to select a replacement for her on the Democratic Party side because she's running unopposed. And so it was a selection process. And so I was actually away doing some military training, and my chief of staff, Javion Johnson, stood in and went through the selection process and everything. And the precinct delegates are the ones who actually decided who would be the Democratic nominee. So that's how it occurred.
We're talking with Inkster Democrat Jewel Jones, who was just elected to represent the 11th district in the State House at the age of 21. You were just 20 when you were elected to the city council in Inkster in 2015. What issues have you dealt with on the city council? What issues were being faced when you joined the council?
So I know we were definitely in a tight fiscal situation, and we were under consent agreement. So spending was tight. Developing the city wasn't too hot. We were just still trying to figure out our public education situation because the school system was dissolved. So it was a whole lot going on besides just and not really having the funding and the resources to really handle business the way we should be to really stay afloat. But since then, things have been on the up and up. We got released from the consent agreement. We just changed the city charter that's at least 51 years old, maybe even like 100 years old. We just changed that. So we're getting the city back on track, really empowering the citizens again, and then taking an active a more active role on developing the city as far as what we would like to see as citizens in the city and what would really get the city back on, you know, back afloat. So there's been a multitude of issues, but you know, it's been a process so far, but we have a good team out here, and the citizens have really stepped up, so things are looking really good out in Inkster.
What do you think you brought to the table, Jewel, as a city councilman?
I think a different way of thinking. You know, it's been a while. It's been not pointing fingers at anyone, but the council and the mayor before we all got elected. It's been the same for quite a while, and we had five new individuals get on the council and the mayor. So, I mean, really changed the entire dynamics of the city. And me being just a young person and having a different perspective and, like I said earlier, talking to different people and having a different experience and seeing the transition of things going up from when I was younger to, you know, when I turned 20, just resources being on the decline, services being on the decline, and just thinking creatively how we can combat it. And being able to sit down and talk to, you know, my more seasoned colleagues, I think just the diversity really, really helped out with us moving the city forward.
I would think you must have learned so much just in your short time on the city council. I can't even. What did you learn?
Well, I really learned more about people over time. I mean, there's so many different mindsets and abilities that people have. I really learned that building a team is important. I think that's probably one of the biggest takeaways from campaigning and from being on city council, that it's all about cultivating a team. Because at the end of the day, if you really want to get the ball rolling, you got to work together. And, you know, people think differently, we have different opinions, but at the end of the day, as long as we can settle on one focused mission, I think that's really what's important to get things moving forward.
We're talking with Inkster Democrat Jewel Jones, who was just elected to represent the 11th District in the State House of Michigan at the age of 21. You're a student at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Can you maintain your studies and serve your district in Lansing at the same time?
Oh, yes, I believe so. It's all about just staying focused. And I only have a few classes left, so I'm looking forward to wrapping up school as well as serving the people come May. So.
That proves you are a young person. That sounds so daunting to me.
Got to use that energy while I have it.
I guess so. I hope you got a lot of it. You're probably aware of this by now, but a man who went on to become governor was first elected to the State House at the age of 22, John Engler.
Okay.
So a little history lesson. Since you're only 21, we expect you to become U.S. Senator. How's that?
Okay, I see what I can do.
Do you have
any, where God takes us.
Do you have any political role models, Jewel?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. I think the way I look at role models, I really take what I can from each individual that I encounter. But definitely like the mayor out here in Inkster, some of my colleagues on council, David Kinesic, definitely President Barack Obama. I can go on for a while. It's like so many people out that just, everyone's so different and everyone approaches things a different way. So I think I take what I can from, you know, different individuals to really learn how to navigate in the political arena and just in the community in general. So
you'll be part of the minority party in the House, although I'm sure Sam Singh will be helpful to you. Sam is our local state representative here, and he's the Democrats' new leader in the House. Have you gotten to meet him yet?
Oh yeah. He's a really good guy. Looking forward to working with him.
We want to thank Jewel Jones, Inkster Democrat, who was just elected to represent the 11th District in the State House. Jewel is 21 years of age, and he's going to continue his studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, for a while he serves in the State House. Good luck to you.
All right, thanks, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
Well, it's what college football fans far and wide are talking about today around the water cooler. Michigan traveling to Columbus in a game that was decided in double overtime. Eventually, the Buckeyes were crowned victorious after a controversial fourth down run that eventually led to the game-winning score from Curtis Samuel. How does all this impact the college football playoff? Oh, that's one of many questions we have for current sports host Al Martin here today. Hi, Al.
Mark, how you doing? Happy Monday.
We're back at it here on the Monday after Thanksgiving. So was JT Barrett's one-yard fourth down run in overtime number two, was it a first down?
Well, that is the question, as you just alluded to, Mark. Everyone's talking about it, and it's one of those plays. Now, granted, let's just be all clear here. Michigan did not lose this game because of that play. Just want to make that clear to everybody out there, because I feel like there's so much talk surrounding around that one moment that we're forgetting about everything else that happened prior to that second overtime, right? But, you know, what I think happened was, and you look at the angle of how the play played out, Mark, you see JT Barrett, and me personally, from what I saw in the film, which is, again, it's a funny angle because they don't have an angle that goes straight down the first down line. You just have that bird's eye angle from the broadcast. And from that angle, it does look like JT Barrett's forward progress may have carried him right to the line. But what puzzled me was how the referees handled the situation. And this is where this discussion gets very interesting, Mark. The referees, what really surprised me, number one, was that they didn't even bring out the chains to measure it. Number two, they were very quick to rule it a first down. And that's what made it sticky, Mark, because once you make a call that it is a first down on the field, if it is chosen to be reviewed, which it was, there has to be indisputable video evidence. It's got to be clear cut that that football is short or past the first down line. Mm-hmm. Looking at that angle that we saw multiple times, it's not indisputable. So you know what they have to do? They have to go with the way they ruled it. But, again, that play is not why Michigan lost this game, no, Mark. There were multiple plays that played out not in favor of Michigan that led to that moment.
Jim Harbaugh was pretty displeased in the postgame press conference. What'd you make of his rant?
Yeah, you know, it was a very emotional one, Mark. And, you know, I'm wondering whether or not the NCAA is going to hand out a fine or two here, because anytime you ruffle the feathers of the officials, they come down and they attack your wallet. But, you know, looking at the rant that he had, Mark, you know, five times, I counted, he spoke of being bitter or, quote, bitterly disappointed by the officials. And, you know, just playing around with the numbers here, and I went back and looked up the season averages for Michigan and OSU when it came to penalties this season, and it's just really kind of enlightening when you evaluate them. Michigan had seven penalties. OSU had just two. That entire game, including, you know, that includes the double overtime here. OSU averaged almost seven penalties a game this season, and they only have two in that game against Michigan. So that's a bit surprising to me. That ranks OSU 78th nationally. For U of M, they averaged almost five penalties nationally. That ranks 18th. And, you know, you look at those numbers, and again, the fact that OSU just had two throughout the game, there were some questionable calls. Now, again, you don't want to blame a game on the referees, because at the end of the day, you got to go out there and make plays. But I will say that the penalty disparity between OSU and Michigan did help the Buckeyes in that matchup.
Is there now any way, I'm led to believe that there is still a chance Michigan could make the college football playoff?
How
exactly?
And there are a lot of fans that may be out there, or a lot of listeners right now listening to this and saying that you got to be crazy. I mean, Michigan, they lost to Iowa, and they now lose to Ohio State. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Nothing that the College Football Playoff Committee does surprises me anymore, Mark, especially when you look at these rankings that have been coming out each and every Tuesday leading up to the final ranking, which will come out December 4th. The committee loves Michigan. They've shown that. Heck, when they lost to Iowa, Michigan was still ranked, according to the committee, in the top four. The way that they played Ohio State, the number two college football team in the nation, we all know how it's going to play out. Alabama, in my opinion, it's Alabama than everybody else. Alabama's going to make the college football playoff. Ohio State, with this win over Michigan, despite the fact that they won't be playing in a conference championship game in Indy this week, Ohio State's still going to make it because this win looks really sexy against Michigan. Mm-hmm. Then you look at those final two spots. Clemson, barring a crazy finish to the season, they will get in, I believe. But then you look at that fourth spot.
Washington?
I right now would have Washington. If you told me what my top four would look like, Alabama, Michigan, well, excuse me, Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, and then Washington.
I didn't know he was going to say that,
exactly.
By the way.
I know,
just for the record.
Pretty good, Mark.
I totally,
pretty good.
Totally improvised that.
But it's crazy to think, though, because the eye test comes into play so much here, Mark. I wouldn't be surprised if the committee said, you know what? Despite the fact that we have Penn State and Wisconsin competing in the Big Ten Championship, Michigan had such a good year. They have so many notable wins this season, including pushing the number two team in Ohio State to the brink. Why not have some fun and throw them in there? I would not be surprised if they did that. Hmm. What are the chances of them doing that? Very slim. But at the same time, I would not be surprised if they said, you know what, the heck with the Big Ten Championship winner. Let's throw in Michigan because they look pretty good throughout much of this year.
WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports every day on AM 870, joins me. We're talking about weekend sports, Michigan football. Michigan State played its final game of the season on Sunday. Tough loss, 45-12 on the road. Let's take a quick look back. Where do you think we stand right now, and how do we move forward?
Well, no question, Mark, that this was a disappointing year for Coach D'Antonio. I think, you know, as I've been coming on here each and every Monday, I've been letting that be known. I think that, I mean, anybody can see that, right? I mean, you come off a year in which Michigan State, talk about the college football playoff, Michigan State played in the college football playoff to start this year, right? In Texas against Alabama, for goodness sake. And now to think that a year removed from that remarkable moment, that they won't even make a bowl game. Pretty insane, right? The thing is, this team is young. And they have a lot of experience now going through the fire like they did this year. They have a lot of experience now coming back next season. Granted, you look at Tyler O'Connor, who started the year as a starting quarterback, and we all know how that quarterback drama played out this season. But you look at the guys in back of Tyler O'Connor now. You have Damian Terry, who we saw and who also went out against Penn State with concussion on Saturday. But with that being said, I mean, you have Messiah DeWeaver, Damian Terry, also Brian Lewerke, who, of course, had an injury that led to his season being kaput earlier this season. You have those three competing for a starting quarterback position. I love that. You got L.J. Scott, who he finished just 6 yards away from 1,000 yards on the season.
That's cool.
Just 6 yards away. I mean, L.J. Scott is going to be a force to be reckoned with for time to come. You got a lot of young linemen that are maturing and have matured throughout the season. So the good thing is, despite the fact that the record is nowhere near what MSU fans expected this team to be, you still have a lot of young pups that will be assuming bigger roles, and this experience helps in that maturation process.
Let's switch gears to basketball because it's been a busy start to the season for Tom Izzo. We just got back from the Battle for Atlantis tournament in the Bahamas. We won 3 of 4, but Tom wasn't happy with the outcome. How come?
You know what? And this is something that we rarely see Tom Izzo do, but, you know, while in the Bahamas, Tom Izzo actually apologized to his team. And he came out and said that, you know what? I apologize to my team. I've always wanted to prepare, and I always believed in preparing a tough schedule, but maybe this was a bit too harsh. I mean, this is the toughest November, Mark, that this program has ever had.
And it's not over.
And it's not over. I mean, tomorrow we're talking about Duke. They had to go on the road and play Duke tomorrow,
exactly.
Right? But they played Kentucky. They played Arizona.
Yeah.
And that's not to mention the amount of miles they put on. Mark, if you tally, and it's crazy how ESPN had a graphic that tallied the miles that Michigan State has traveled this month alone. It's longer than some NBA teams out there. It's so crazy. And, you know, this team is very young. Granted, they have a great recruiting class, arguably Tom Izzo's best recruiting class that he's ever had. But they're still young, and they're still trying to figure out who they are as a basketball team. But I love it, though, because you know what? It seems like we do this every year, though. Tom Izzo plays a tough schedule, this top-heavy schedule every single season, and he does it to see early where the holes in the boat are. Mm-hmm. So he knows how to go about plugging those holes and just exactly what his team needs to do if they want to make a deep run come March. And heck, they're always humming near March, Mark.
We've just got 30 seconds or less. What are the chances the Lions hold on to their divisional lead?
I think very good. If you look at the way that the schedule plays out for them, and the fact that, and this is the big thing, I think, that a lot of people aren't talking about, Mark, the fact that they are healthy. I mean, in comparison to everybody else in the NFC North, the Lions have all 53 members of the active roster either fully healthy or at least practicing. That's something that you can't say for any other team. And the fact that, you know, they play a few lollipops coming down here until they play the Cowboys at the end of the season. the schedule was in their favor.
And we want to congratulate the PW Pirates. I watched them win on Saturday. It was just fantastic.
How cool is that? And Jackson Lumen Christie as
that's
well.
Right.
We had two local teams play. Very good weekend.
More with Al Martin on WKAR's Current Sports AM 870 every weekday at 1 p.m. Thank you, Al.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Anytime.
Welcome back. Tomorrow on Current State, Go Girl may sound like a rock band, but it's actually a Wayne State University program designed to help girls build confidence and careers in the STEM fields. The deadline to register for the special program is this week. We'll have all the details, plus the Detroit-based Sphinx organization, which teaches underprivileged youths, recently sent 4 students to perform at the White House for Michelle Obama. We'll speak with their director about that performance opportunity of a lifetime. That's tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and welcome back, Drew Hill. Have a great day. We'll see you Tuesday on Current State on WKAR.